How would you like to build a property portfolio? Lane Kawaoka will tell us how, and he's a property investor and he's a licensed industrial engineer who spent 12 years quietly building a rental property portfolio while working in his engineering career. In starting his investing journey in 2009 in rainy Seattle, his frugal lifestyle allowed him to purchase his first property soon after college. So, Lane, tell us about how can entrepreneurs build a large property portfolio?
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashko shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I guess we'll dig into it, but it all starts with just buying one little rental property, running the numbers on it. The way I did it, I just saved up 20% down payment, got a bank loan for the rest. And then I'm a big proponent to getting a property manager to deal with the tenants, termites and toilets and all the headaches of being a landlord. And you kind of focus on the way you make money, right? Like for a lot of us, whether you're a doctor or a dentist, an engineer, or you run your own business, that's the way you produce income and you use that to get more down payments to buy more and more properties.
Thank you. So I assume a large part of your system is actually to be employed initially, because that is a good way for you to, get loans from the bank. And it's actually an easier way for you to get loans from the bank while you are employed and you have like a safety net. And then you kind of quietly build a property for portfolio, kind of starting with one and kind of like keeping on buying more and more and more, and then making sure that the numbers work for every single property, right?
That's correct. I mean, like real estate is a very capital intensive business. And you'd utilize bank loans because it's something that the banks really love, right? The banks love real estate. Why would you not? So that's how I got started when I was working my engineering job at the time. Bought a first property in 2009, then saved up to buy a duplex a few years later. By 2015, I had 11 of these little rental properties. And then, started to learn what wealthy people did. A lot of business owners get involved in real estate, but get involved more on the commercial scale in syndications and private placements.
Thank you. For people who are starting out building their property portfolio, aside from, buy your first property and kind of make the numbers on it, what would you like them to know in terms of what would be your 10 commandments for someone who is starting from scratch to build a property portfolio? What are some really key, important elements they need to follow?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is like run the numbers. When you're buying these properties, there's a rule called the 50% rule, where, you take, 50% of the rents coming in. That's pretty much how much you should conservatively expect to keep at the end of the month to pay your debt service. So, you need to look for a property that's going to cash flow, that has a high rent to value ratio. So, and I didn't realize this my first few properties, right? Like I was buying in Seattle, Washington, a very high priced area. I just didn't realize that you could buy properties across the country where the numbers are a lot better. So one quick exercise people could do at home right now, this is kind of simple that you could do from a podcast form, is, look at the house that you live in or the place you rent. What is it worth? You could probably go on Zillow and find the rough price for it. What is the rental price? You take the rental price divided by the market purchase price, and that's the rent to value ratio. So for example, at the time I was buying a lot of these $100,000 houses that rented for $1,000 a month. So the math goes 1,000 divided by 100 grand, that's 1%. So that's kind of the key mark that you're trying to look for, right? Something that's like around that 1% or better. For those people who, live in Hawaii now, California, Seattle, you're just not going to find those properties that have a good rent to value ratio. There, you might find a place in the ghetto for 400 grand that rents for $2,000 a month. Right? The math just doesn't work there. That's 2,000 divided by 400 grand. That's 0.5%. Not going to work. So that's the first place to start.
Thank you. Tell us the other 9 steps of your 10 commandments for someone who would start to build their property portfolio from scratch. What other really important steps they need to follow?
Yeah, the next thing I would say is like look at the location of the property. We typically, as investors, we kind of grade neighborhood locations A, B, C, just like in grade school. where your A's are your best areas, your B is your more blue collar mix, your C class is more of your blue collar. I usually go by, like the A class areas are all the places that I'm sure all the podcast people listening here would love to live in, right? These are the nicest areas, but the numbers aren't really going to work in a lot of these places because you're competing against homeowners. The B class area is sort of the sweet spot, I think. You're going to find that this place, it's safe during the day, but maybe you don't want to be there too much at nighttime, right? But it's a great place to pick up good cash flowing properties. The C class, a little bit rougher. I wouldn't really want to be hanging out during the daytime. And you're going to be running into a little bit more difficult clientele in that type of stratosphere. So you're starting to, as you notice, we don't want to be slumlords here, right? We want to find that nice little sweet spot. We also want to have cash flowing properties where the rent to value ratios are well. So there's a little bit of sweet spot in that B class area. Some people get confused what I'm going to talk about next, which is like grading the asset, right? So, newer properties, things built in the last couple of decades, so built 2000 and later, these would probably be called more class A type of assets, newer assets. Your class B is going to be your 1970s to 1990s, that type, few decades old, getting older, right? And then your class C stuff is like your 1960s and older. You're going to have a lot of deferred maintenance, a lot of costs that pop up here and there. Again, there's a bit of a sweet spot in that middle there, right? But that's like another way that, investors will quickly grade properties. And at least, when you're conversing with another investor, that's really where, you need to kind of start to speak the lingo, right? Or if you're learning anything, especially in investing in any type of avenue such as this, where you're putting up big sums of cash, it's important to kind of start to learn the lingo and get acclimated to the asset class.
Thank you. So you typically invest in B areas?
Typically, yeah. So like when I first got started, I was investing in Seattle, Washington, right? Which is known to be a pretty nice area, primary market, which I would probably say the numbers just don't work there, right? Like places like New York, Boston, Miami, like Los Angeles, Seattle, right? It's just not going to work. Portland. The other thing, as I say, Portland, right? Like the other thing is we try to stick to more red states, right? I'm not to say anything politically, but when you're the landlord, you tend to want to be in more of the red states, right? So a lot of places like Portland or Seattle, it's hard to evict tenants when they don't pay, which I'm not going to say if it's right or wrong, but as a landlord, it's not the best for you. So a lot of these secondary markets that we'll look at are less sexy, like a Phoenix, a Dallas, a Houston, Oklahoma City, to name a few. These are that second, they're still large cities, at least maybe 500,000 people, million plus sit in the city. But, you're not those top headlines, gateway cities.
Thank you. Where do you currently invest? In terms of areas?
It's changed. Yeah, it's certainly changed over the years. We tend to stick to these Sun Belt states. So Sun Belt of America can be categorized from Arizona, Texas, Alabama, it's up to the Florida for a few reasons. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, politically, it's a little bit more red state, a little bit economic driven, especially for the lower middle class, right? Like, again, I think I might have mentioned it earlier, like my investment thesis is to invest in workforce housing. So not really high-end luxury properties like the class A stuff, as I was mentioning. More things that, the reason why is this is where the majority of Americans' population is. Majority of Americans do not live in $2,000 plus apartments. They live in $800 to $1,200 a month apartments. And they don't live in Los Angeles, Seattle, New York. They live in these more, middle market cities, these second tier cities. And I think that's when you add in there the layer of like the rich are getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and the middle class, the people that we try to bring into our community to invest in these types of investments so that they can save themselves from being the lower middle class. It's just inevitable, right? Unless you invest. So this is where, we start to realize like, wow, the need for these workforce housing apartments are getting greater and greater. And that's why at the end of the day, I like to invest in these types of things.
So you're saying that you're mainly investing in like $100,000 kind of apartments, as a general rule?
I mean, when before I switched over to commercial investing, most of the properties I bought were like $70,000 to $120,000. So yeah, you're right there. What I would probably say is, you could probably ask ChatGPT these days, like, what is 80% of the median home price? That's typically where we like to be, right around, right? Because that's quite categorically the lower middle class right there, right? 80% of the median home price. Not many people can afford houses these days. The, Gen, I don't know what are we on these days? Like Gen Z, millennials, they don't have the jobs. They're in the student debt these days. Even if they could, if they were professionals, they can't afford houses. It's a changing world out there, and apparently the new ones can't even find jobs out there with AI taking their entry-level jobs too. I mean, these are all things that I don't think are good for society, but as an investor, I have to go where the fuck is going.
Thank you. So your strategy is basically buying as many of these houses as possible at the lowest possible price that kind of makes sense financially. And that is like a way to also distribute the wealth so that it you kind of like that's another way for you to de-risk portfolio, right? By investing in so many different like eggs and so many different baskets.
So there's geographic diversification there, right? Like I never know what's going to happen in one geographic area. Sorry, I'm hearing a lot of feedback there. Yeah, so I see that where the puck is going, that there, you never know where, if anything's going to happen, right? Some natural disaster, some economic boom, some economic despair. So you try to diversify geographically. Typically you want to be in multiple cities, multiple states. When I was investing in 11 rental properties back in 2015, I think I straddled Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis were my major markets that I had multiple rental properties in. The other thing too is, I think where we're seeing populations, demographics go, it's more and more people are not going to be able to afford a house, especially with high interest rates. And they're going to be forced to be lifelong renters. And in fact, actually, they're okay with it, apparently. You're more economically mobile, you pay less in debt service. And I think most younger people will prefer to have a newer property, and it okay to be a few hundred square feet smaller than they would have gotten otherwise.
Thank you. What are the top ways to de-risk or protect or safeguard your investment when you're investing in property?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at any investment, we look at the P&Ls, right? Like, we're not investing in angel investments or venture capital where there's no income or revenue coming in. Not to say that that's not a bad way to invest, right? Like, you could make huge asymmetric returns. But the reason that I like investing in real estate is that it is somewhat, you can kind of look in the rearview mirror on how these things have been running. You can look at the profit and loss statement on an apartment 2 years back. You typically get clean financials for that, and you can extrapolate how this asset will work in the future, or at least right now today. We just had the NBA had a bunch of guys gambling, right, with insider trading, essentially, right, figuring out who was injured before making bets. And in the stock market, you can't do insider trading; that's illegal. But with rental real estate, you absolutely should invest with the best information that's whether that you can get. If you know a certain employer's going in, or population is going up and the census hasn't just changed it yet, that's a great way to invest, right? A lot of this is driven by jobs and population. It's not that complicated. And you're looking at where rents are picking up in certain markets. A lot of this data is out there. I mean, just ChatGPT, it's pretty easy to get this data. And a lot of this is, at the end of the day, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to be a real estate investor. People need a place to live, and it's a resource that's ever going down. At least in America, population is still looks like it's going to be going up for another generation, unlike other countries out there. But even if it stays flat, the lower middle class, I think, is still going to be going up.
Thank you. How do you choose from, let's say, properties that have similar rental potential, but not necessarily similar in terms of desirability? And you did mention some factors like, I know, mobility of people and schools and this kind of thing. Because, and the reason I ask you this, okay, is because I worked as a property manager for 14 years, and I was managing 30 properties. And at some point, I remember that I got this property that was not in my usual area. Okay, it was a lot more central. It was in Zone One, like more, in London. And what I thought was quite funny about it is that the property was like internally, it had to be like pretty much like reconstructed and so on because there was a fire or something. And I was able to rent the entire thing in such a fast, at a, such a fast pace that I realized really quickly that I sold it too cheap, and I never had this kind
It's
of
seller's
like,
remorse, right?
I never had like this kind of like such a fast pace in terms of like so much desirability for that area. And I mean, I was renting just really close to there, like you could say 5 minutes by bus, but somehow that particular area was like, it was like hotcakes, So I'm wondering, like, how do you did mention ChatGPT. Are there any other sources where it's, where you can find out, let's say, in terms of choosing a particular area, which one is hotter in terms of like fast rental? And it's not, even if, let's say, the pricing could be the same between, let's say, area A and area B, but then in terms of like how fast it goes, actually, area A is a lot faster in terms of it renting out really fast. How do you find out
So here's
which
the thing, right?
area?
Like when you're buying properties, they have this metric out there that's very easily available called days on market. Usually 30 to 60 days is kind of the equilibrium for most markets out there. But when you're talking rental real estate, right? I mean, there's not really a metric for that that you can easily obtain. Luckily, with rental real estate, I think this is where some investors they don't quite understand that they don't need to do everything. This is more of the job of their property management firm, right? To have their finger on the pulse, to know this. And this is where you, as the investor, need to query the right people and be open-minded and collaborative with your team members, such as your property manager. So, like, hey, man, like, what do you think about this property? What do you think about that property, right? Like, I mean, you can't just waste their time, right? But if you're a client of theirs or you have high intention to use them, they're usually totally fine getting a cup of coffee or just getting on a quick phone call and giving your, their assertion of the market. When we look at properties, we get the P&Ls and rent rolls, and we see how the property's been performing the last couple of months. But there's another aspect that I didn't really mention is we usually go in and we renovate the properties. We do some type of value add. Typically we'll maybe put $5,000 to $10,000 of into each unit to, renovate the flooring, appliances, new paint job. We'll clean up the showroom, for the new tenants coming in, right? But that's not that much money to get maybe $100, $200 rent bump there. This is why we really like invest. You can't get much done for $25,000, $50,000 in one of those things. And I don't know if you'll see that rental bump from that. But yeah, we'll pull in our property management. We use commercial property managers, and we own a lot of, some of these we own 1,000+ units in one area. So we'll kind of know ourselves. We'll collaborate with our team or our property management firm to figure out where are the hot areas, right? We're doing this before we're even buying. But then we'll layer on top of that too, is like, where's the value add potential? Which are the properties that we can just put in some new flooring and bump the rents up $250, right? Like, that's the third piece to it. I think to do that though, the first several dozen properties I bought personally, I didn't really do any renovations to it. I just bought it and held it. I didn't really do anything to it. As you get more experience, I think that's when you start to do renovation. Or if you don't have the time for that, that's when you join the syndication as a passive investor, an LP partner, and you find a firm like ours to get more involved to do all the heavy lifting for you. And then we I'll kind of partner in that asset to improve it over the long run. But you know, it's, I think that in the beginning, as I don't want to complicate it too much for folks, really, like I want people to get started, right? Buy your own little rental property, just get in the game, right? That's how you learn at the end of the day. You know, a lot of this is, it is intuitive once you get into it, right?
Thank you. What do property investors need to know about property syndications that you mentioned if they want to get involved with something like that?
Yeah, I mean, typically, I mean, you can get into some deals out there if you're not a credit investor, but typically it's my belief that if you're, these deals where you're getting involved directly with the operator or sponsor, you need to be an accredited investor. So net worth $1 million or greater, or I think the threshold is $200,000 of income per year. At that point, you know, you probably have enough where we'll fall. If you lost the money, you'd be okay, right? That's really at the end of the day, this is, and that's what investing is. If you can't risk it, you ain't gonna get any biscuit at the end of the day for this stuff. Unfortunately, that's, you know, a lot of people are non-accredited investors out there. When I was first investing my first 10 years, I was not an accredited investor. The thing is, well, how the hell do I get there, right? Like, that's a chicken to egg thing. To me, I think that's where you really have to just buy your little rental properties on your own, save your money. You know, like I said, down payment to get started in this world is 20, 25 grand to on a $100,000 house, 20% down payment, and maybe a few grand extra for some reserves. And you're off and rolling. You know, this is not a get rich quick scheme. This is just a buy and save more money and buy some more game. But it quickly does steamroll after a while.
Thank you. What other things would you put in place to de-risk or safeguard your investment?
Yeah, I mean, operation on a turnkey rental isn't the, you know, there's not a lot of things that can go wrong. You know, in terms of, you know, it's, people need a place to live. The rents are going to be within this range. But, you know, operationally, you're getting the bad tenant in there, knowing what to do when you get a bad tenant, things break, you know, getting that property manager, as you've kind of mentioned, like is, I think, critical. A lot of people shortchange not getting a property manager and saving that 10%. I think that's a little silly. I think that starts with property selection. If you can't afford that, you probably shouldn't have bought that property in the first place, right? But I think, you know, by getting people on your team like that, like professional property managers, you can start to de-risk your investment. And there's always going to be risks, right? I mean, when I had, you know, 11 properties, I always lost money on a few of them every single year. But as a whole, right, as I was diversified and I pooled my investments together, you know, I kind of hit my projection numbers for the year.
Thank you. What would you say are the top mistakes that property investors make that cause them to lose money?
First thing first is like going to the numbers, as I mentioned. On my website, I have a free rental property e-course, and in there is a spreadsheet analyzer. I think, you know, yeah, we talked about the rent-to-value ratio calculation, but once you find something that is within striking range, that's when I think you have to put it into the full analyzer. And you have to break down all the expenses, the debt service, the insurance, the taxes, get real quotes for that. And then you also have to account for CapEx, which is a thing that a lot of people forget. What is CapEx? Well, you know, like on your house, you have the roof, you have the appliances break, right? Things that don't necessarily happen every single month or even every year. But you have to allocate, you know, maybe a few hundred dollars here and there to replacing the roof, which might be 20 grand every 20 years or so, right? So these are the hidden liabilities that, you know, people forget about that catches up with them and ultimately drags them in the red at the end of the year.
Thank you. What else would you like entrepreneurs to know about building a property portfolio?
Yeah, so here's my thing, specifically for your audience. I mean, if you're making a successful business, more than likely your time and your time resource, and I'm kind of getting a little meta here, your time is a resource that has a finite amount. There's a lot of people out there flipping houses, you know, wholesaling houses. Now, that is more active on the side of real estate investing. To me, that's not investing. That's just being an active real estate operator. But everybody has an hourly rate out there. If you run a successful business where you're making multiple six figures, I would probably argue that your best use for your time is probably in that property as opposed to messing around with rental real estate in terms of flipping. But rental real estate has other advantages, right? Like it kind of runs itself, especially when you get that property manager in there. And we didn't really talk about too much, but the great tax benefits you can get from owning real estate, right? So the idea is fill up your bucket first in terms of your own business or your job, right? For some people, make money there. And any excess that you don't need, you know, maybe you need to hire some staff, maybe you need to pay for some Meta ads or Google ads, do that first, optimize the business. But then once you're like, well, business is good, you know, I've been reinvesting for years, and you take those profits and put into real estate for the tax savings and the long-term growth from there.
Thank you. Tell us about what superpower team would you need to put in place to build a property portfolio?
Property manager, the real estate broker to help you buy the asset. You know, if you're already an accredited investor, the game kind of changes, right? You're not really buying the properties yourselves. You're looking for a team of operators and sponsors to run the deal for you, right? Your general partners, because you'll be in the passive investor role. The thing there is like, well, how do you find these deals? How do you find these operators? This is why we kind of host events very sparingly throughout the year for accredited investors only. You know, I think that's where, you know, the saying goes, your network is your net worth, right? It wasn't, I had 11 rentals in 2015, and I thought that, you know, this is the way to financial freedom, buying dozens and dozens of rental properties. And then I started to realize, because I started to interact and build relationships with other accredited investors, that there was a level after rental property ownership. You know, and this is where, you know, I wrote my book, you know, talking about these different layers or the different floors of the wealth building journey. You know, once you become an accredited investor, you're effectively off of the first floor into the second floor of the wealth elevator. And that was kind of where, you know, in the book, I talk about what happens after that, right? The third floor, the family office level, you know, the way you invest changes over the years. Now, you might be a successful entrepreneur, but if you look at very high net worth people, they kind of pivot through the wealth building. You know, when they get to $5 million net worth, they get to $50 million net worth. The strategies change and where they focus their time and energy change. And, you know, so if people are interested, they can kind of check out the book, The Wealth Elevator, on Amazon.
Thank you. Tell us what's different about how you said when you reach a certain level in your property portfolio, about $5 million, your strategy needs to change. Tell us some of the aspects that will change in terms of the strategy you will follow for building a property portfolio from $5 million upwards.
Yeah, it's different for everybody, right? But if we were just to put a range on it, $5 to $10 million net worth is typically that arena where people get on the third floor of the wealth elevator. And the reason being is, you know, at that level, you could probably put your money into something, a low risk, low return investment, like T-bills, right? To give something tangible talking about. You know, some people in our community will be doing closed-end funds or life insurance, but, you know, there are a bunch of these kind of low risk, low return types of investments, the set it and forget it things. They're great investments if you have a lot of money, right? And you don't need a lot of yield. And at $10 million at what, 3%, that's 300 grand a year, right? That's a lot for most people out there. But the idea is like, you know, if you're on the first floor or the second floor of the wealth elevator, you're still needing to grow your net worth to that level, right? So different prospectuses out there. So you're going to need to take on more risks. You need to get into more riskier, higher returning things. You need to be, you know, saving more taxes in that way. You know, getting into more of these types of alternative investments. But when you get to that little level, that tipping point, or what we call financial freedom, some people call this, right? The goals change for some. For others, you know, some minority folks out there want to, you know, grow up past 10 figures or 8 figures to 9 figures from, you know, right? But, you know, typically that will take a couple of generations for most people to do, right? We work with first generation multimillionaires to get to that second, third floor of the wealth elevator. But really that's where, you know, to get anywhere past that, you have to build your own network, right? So if you don't know anybody who's an accredited investor around you, you really, you know, you need to have one, then you need to have 5, and then you need to have 30 people who are accredited investors around you for, you know, not only the relationships and the fun, but, you know, getting deal flow and the strategies.
Thank you. Tell us the biggest lessons you've learned whilst building your property portfolio?
You know, again, like I thought rental property is the way to financial freedom until I met the right people. You know, until I started to hang out with other accredited investors, I didn't realize that there was this second floor of the wealth elevator. The journey begun, right? And later I discovered what's beyond that, right? And that's why I put it in all in the book, because I feel like it's important to kind of know not only what's on the next floor up, but two floors above up, right? So you can not only get there faster, but if there's possibilities for people to cheat and step up along the way. Like, for example, the second property I bought was a duplex, right? Duplex tend to have a little bit better numbers than just a single family home. But if you're somebody who is trying to, you know, have a high income and want to sell that property, your exit strategy on that duplex is going to be a lot worse than a single family home. So in those that respect, if you had a bigger picture view of how the floors work, you wouldn't have bought a duplex, triplex, or quad.
Thank you. What would be your message for entrepreneurs wanting to build a property portfolio?
Figure out where you're at. I mean, like, advice doesn't mean anything unless it's personalized to where you're at. You know, I can tell some people out there to stop buying a latte at Starbucks because they don't have any money. They're bad at budgeting. That'd be great advice for them. But for most of my clients, that's horrible advice. Like, their time is more valuable than money for some. And if the kick that they get from that caffeine is going to get them to close another deal or do another investment, then that's probably a good use of money there. But I would say people need to understand where they are at first, right? And that's why they got to pick up the book. They need to figure out what floor of the wealth elevator they are at, and then figure out the strategies. Because unfortunately, we live in like this TikTok world where there's all this random advice, these short 15 or 40 second clips. But they may be good tips, but who is it for, right? That's the important thing.
Thank you. What is the best way to build a property network where you can find the kind of deals that can lead towards your financial freedom? You mentioned events, but are there any other locations where that you recommend people meet?
The key thing here is to find people or find events where the caliber of people are what you're looking for, right? Like, if you're an accredited investor, net worth $1 million or greater, you need to only be hanging out with people $1 million or greater. And I would say, like, for those folks, the local real estate club is probably the worst place to go, because a lot of those guys are just flipping houses or wholesaling houses. A lot of them have net worths under $250,000, right? So I think you need to always try to be shooting above your weight class. If your net worth is $500,000, you need to be hanging out with people $500,000 or greater. And unfortunately, you have to pay for a lot of these types of access. You know, our group, we kind of work with people that are between that $1 to $10 million range, right? And that's why I take a lot of great care in vetting everybody coming in. We want to know who people are, so it's just not a random room of, you know, real estate newbies or people who are just kind of getting started, right? Because again, they're all going in different directions, different strategies, right? For people at different net worth ranges. So I would say whenever you get, you know, events are great somewhat, they can be a waste of time, but when you get there, figure out what the net worths are around the room.
Thank you. Any other places where people can meet the right property deals and property landlords that may have the kind of deals they're looking for to buy?
We're going to be doing our event in Hawaii in January. So if they are a credit investor, you know, maybe reach out team@thewealthelevator.com.
Thank you. Tell us where property investors can connect with you.
They could check out the book, The Wealth Elevator, on Amazon. And if they buy a copy and email us a receipt, we'll hook them up with the PDF and the MP3 version. If you're our credit investor, shoot me an email, lane@thewealthelevator.com.
Thank you.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.